Interviewed Ben Fisher on February 2nd, 1977. Okay, this is tape three, side five, and the other interviews were done by Estelle Krumman and Mrs. Berkman. Ben, first of all, what I'd like you to do, since I went over your transcripts, would you like to update your five children? Is there anything new that you want to tell?
One of them died. Mark died. The other children are scattered. My son is in Harpers Ferry, West Virginia. I have a daughter in Reston, Virginia. A daughter in Chevy Chase, Maryland. A daughter in New York City, Manhattan. And I have quite a two stepchildren, Jill Hast, who is here in Pittsburgh, and Gary Randall, who is in Los Angeles. And I have three of my own grandchildren. Michael, who has graduated college and has just moved back to Washington. And Melanie, who was in Los Angeles in the film industry and graduated from NYU Film School. And Hannah, who was H-A-N-A, who was five, and then, of course, I have three step-grandchildren in Los Angeles.
Ben, at the end of the tape, Edna, your second wife, had not died. When did she die?
'79.
Okay.
Shortly after my retirement. The steelworkers.
Okay, could you talk just a tiny bit louder if possible? Okay, then how about telling us about Sylvia?
I met her that fall and married her a year later. We've been married ever since.
Could you tell us a little bit about Sylvia?
She's an honest-to-God native of Pittsburgh. Probably the only native I've ever known, or still. She's the only native I know. Has been has really introduced me into Pittsburgh society, for good or bad, and even into Pittsburgh Jewish society, which is a fascinating place.
Okay, your siblings. You update us. There's the Helen, Leo, and
Helen is the only one vaguely alive in New York, except for being mentally alert, reasonably, somewhat. She is helpless. She's blind and cannot walk. Kind of hangs on in Manhattan. And my two brothers died. One suddenly in Mexico, Bruno the writer. My oldest brother Leo died slowly in a home, torturously, in the most comfortable circumstances. And that's nice for the survivors, but I don't think it meant anything to him. So I'm the remaining one who is with it, and my sister Helen hangs on. She's the oldest.
Ben, you had a very long relationship with Arthur Goldberg, and I'd like to hear a little bit about that.
Well, Arthur Goldberg was a fascinating man who had boundless ambition, a giant ego, and made a terrible, terrible mistake. And he decided to run for governor of New York at a time when it was almost a certainty that he could have been elected senator. Even Rockefeller, who was the governor and his opponent in the race, while he would not have supported Arthur for Senate, would not have gone out of his way to oppose him. They were good friends. I think he was probably euchred into running for governor by the Kennedy Mafia, as they are called, because they wanted to have somebody strategically placed politically to further Bobby's career, or whatever Kennedy's career was involved at the moment. And none of us ever quite understood why Arthur gave in to this. And I remember shortly before the election him saying to me with utter amazement how difficult it was to run against all the millions that Nelson Rockefeller was putting out. What amazed me was not his statement, but that he was amazed at Rockefeller having money. It was a very sad chapter, and it really marked the end of his significant career, though he did other things. He was our delegate to the Helsinki Conference, and did extremely well there. Whether he did as well as Max Kamperman, who followed him. It's hard to make comparisons because each period is historically self-contained. And then Arthur became an ambassador at large. He practiced law in a very intermittent fashion, taught, but never got back to being really comfortable with his lack of power and the kind of importance that was so very meaningful to him.
What about his appointment to the Supreme Court?
Well, that of course came much earlier. His appointment to the Supreme Court was the fruition of what early on he said to me, before anybody could even think in such terms, that his childhood ambition, childhood meaning I assume in his late teens, was and never changed to be a member of the Supreme Court. And his strategy for doing that was supporting Kennedy early. People now forget that Kennedy was far from the liberal or labor candidate, and it was really the Steelworkers Union, nudged by Arthur, that began the momentum that led to Kennedy's becoming the labor candidate in large measure. I recall whether every union supported the Steelworkers Union under Arthur's tutelage and prodding was the first. There were some reasons germane to the steelworkers that I don't care to talk about that led Arthur and Dave McDonald, the president of the steelworkers, to that decision. Arthur was extremely active in the campaign and expected a payoff, which he got, except that he expected to be the attorney general, which he was not. And he told me he was... he did not get the job because Bobby was so anxious to get it, which is, I think, what Jack Kennedy told him. And this myth known as Jack Kennedy, of course, was a politician not much different from his father, except he had a lot more charm and was an updated version. And there's no doubt in my mind that this, if Arthur understood Jack properly, Arthur was not told the truth, because the truth was that Bobby didn't want the job, which historically has now come to earth. He didn't want the job because he didn't know anything about being a lawyer. except what he had learned in law school and never practiced law for a day of his life, and thought himself unqualified, and he was right. But a fellow by the name of Joe dictated the terms based on the fact that it was his belief that Jack needed someone who was a family member, thoroughly, unequivocally trustworthy at his side, and the attorney generalship was the strategic position from which to bring this about. So it was really Joe who you could Bobby into the job. Arthur did not know this. I don't even think Arthur knew this until many, many years later, if he ever knew. In any event, he accepted the job of Secretary of Labor, not with enthusiasm, and over the opposition of George Meany. A almost untold story. And Arthur told me the story of how he was in Jack's home and Jack was beginning to fudge on the secretaryship because of Meany's opposition, whereupon Arthur says, he said, "I thought you had been elected president." And he left in a huff, he said. Well, I did not suggest for one moment this is not true, but each of us tells stories in self-serving fashion all the time. In any event, apparently, he says Jack called him and said he wanted him to take the job, and he took it. I think by that time, in any event, he was tired of being general counsel of the Steelworkers Union. Like so many of us, Arthur never enjoyed being comfortably set in a position. He was always ambitious and wishing to, and not just personally ambitious, but ambitious in terms of conquering new fields and new challenges. He accepted the job. I think in doing so, he was deeply concerned about whether this meant no Supreme Court, but of course, as it turned out, it did mean his appointment to the Supreme Court from a position of Secretary of Labor, which was hardly appropriate historically, and performed very well. Found it to be not nearly as glamorous as he thought it had been. Found out it was a lot of hard work, and Arthur being what he was, it was hard work not only because being on the Supreme Court is quite a task and responsibility, but because Arthur at least told me that he reviewed very thoroughly the briefs, the transcripts, etc., of cases. Supreme Court operates on an alternate week basis. They meet for 1 week and they study and confer for 1 week. Of course, you have adequate help to do a lot of the nitty-gritty work for you, but I assume Arthur did a lot more than some justices do in the way of personally reviewing the cases scheduled for hearing. During his tenure on the Supreme Court, others have told me that he would drop in through the rear door of the White House, confer with Johnson. A practice which one would not want to publicize, one which some people would consider to be, put it mildly, inappropriate. I think this demonstrated his restlessness. I remember walking down Pennsylvania Avenue with one cold Saturday morning. He loved to walk endlessly, and I dutifully tried to keep up because I don't like anything endlessly. And there was some crisis at the moment, and when was there not, in Israel, and he was expressing his regret that he was not positioned as a member of the bench to pick himself up, go over there and take care of it in a few days or weeks or hours maybe. Arthur was anything but modest or retiring. And it is that regret that I, that expression of regret that I remember most when I hear how Johnson forced him to resign from the Supreme Court. I think Arthur couldn't wait to get off. None of the recorded biographies, including that from his wife, indicate that. But on the other hand, it is certainly more comfortable and more self-serving to indicate that one gave in to the pressure of the president than that to suggest one was bored with being a member of the Supreme Court, which is not appropriate in our culture.
Was he pleased with his appointment?
Clearly, when he became ambassador to the United Nations, and perhaps this is forgotten, there were a few crucial matters, a couple of which he took care of, like Pakistan, and did it with great skill because Arthur had consummate skill. And shortly thereafter, he turned his attention to taking care of that stuff over in Vietnam. I assume he thought that was more complicated. It would take him a few weeks on the way to becoming something, either vice president, probably. At that point, I was no longer intimate with Arthur. I was no longer that used to Arthur. And his ambitions were turning elsewhere. And I can't remember which of his associates and friends told me that he anticipated a few weeks of attention to Vietnam and then bask in the glory of that great victory. And knowing Arthur as I did, I think he thoroughly believed that. And of course, as history shows, it didn't quite work that way. And thus, at the appropriate time, he resigned. He did a fine, probably, along with Stevenson, the greatest ambassador to the United Nations we've had, the most effective.
Adlai Stevenson.
Yeah. In some ways, Arthur might have been better because, well, Adlai had the consummate skill of articulating our views and our interests. Arthur, while he didn't have that to a degree, his friend Stevenson had, and they were very close. He did have more skill as a politician, as a problem solver, much more skill as a problem solver. And it was regrettable when he left. And I suppose he decided to go into private practice. Whether he had a secondary agenda of returning on his white horse, I don't know, but it turned out that way. Some of the stories about his getting located in New York are very interesting. His price was very high. One law firm that he was very much interested in and would have really been appropriate in indicated that they could not see any way, they indicated to me that they could not see any way whereby they could justify his price because they didn't think he could bring that much value to the firm. In any event, he didn't practice law very long, but turned back to politics, was very successful in corralling support, wide support, enthusiastic support for his senatorial race. The New York labor movement is not necessarily one that comes together very easily. It has a lot of historical differences. And one of the odd characteristics, unlike most unions in America, that the New York labor movement had was strong Rockefeller support, and well-deserved support, because Rockefeller was a great governor and perhaps the outstanding liberal Republican of our time, or of any time. And no one knew that better than Arthur Goldberg. And when he, without consulting any of the extensive supporters whom he had gathered, support gathering doesn't just mean announcements, it means lots of money. And it costs a lot of money to run for anything in New York. And the commitments were there. Having consulted no one, he turned around one day and announced that he was a candidate for governor. Shocked everybody, caused great consternation, not only because it was an odd way to act in terms of not consulting people whose support you had solicited and obtained, but also because it clearly created great consternation. Lots of schizophrenia in the labor movement and other places in New York. And he lost very resoundingly, as we know, which is unfortunate because Arthur would have been a very great senator. In fact, it might have been the place where he could have really produced for the country the greatest value that was within his...
What year did he run for Senate? Excuse me, Governor, I'm sorry.
I don't know what year that was.
And who won?
I forgot the guy's name. Is it Orr? I think it's Orr.
I'm trying to remember. That's what I'm having difficulty
with. A pretty good senator ran against... He would have been advantaged had they put forward a very conservative or reactionary candidate, but that they did not do. But he could have beat this guy hands. In fact, I'm not sure this fellow would have run.
Do you think it's because of the lack of money?
Oh, no. Rockefeller was a tremendous force in New York, and justifiably. I think he, in many ways, could be said to have been even a greater governor than Lehman.
No, but I'm talking about money for Arthur Goldberg's campaign.
No, no, no. Against Rockefeller? No, he was defeated at the moment he said he was going to be a candidate.
Okay. Why? What is your reason?
Because of Rockefeller, first of all. And second of all, there was nothing in Arthur's career which would justify the claim that he would be a better governor than Rockefeller. And knowing the tremendous support and very solid support that Nelson had in the labor movement, it was nonsense.
And was I've he been that in a, naive? Or?
I don't know. It's amazing what ego can do. Had I been in New York, I would have had a hell of a lot of trouble. I was a great admirer of Nelson. For Pennsylvanians, they have to think in terms of, at least in terms of John Hines. Yeah. And I'd say much more so. Nelson Rockefeller was more liberal than John. He was more solid in a way, more visionary. And the notion of Arthur challenging him just made no sense to me, except as in terms of building towards presidential power, either being a kingmaker or being on a slate or something. There's no other understanding I can have, and I do not dismiss the fact that with Arthur's boundless ambition and his marvelous image of himself, what could be?
Could the religion have had any effect?
No. Oh, in terms of being the governor? No, he should have had the support of the Jewish community, but there was no, I don't know if he had or not, but I doubt it, because the Jewish community had infinite number of connections with Rockefeller, and for good reason. Some Jewish, and just some because even the Jews were citizens of New York. Unlike Pittsburgh, where Jews are not citizens of the city.
What... did Arthur Goldberg finally do before? What was the last?
He opened an office and he consulted occasionally. He taught at least one law school, served on committees and commissions, and made pronouncements, and occasionally conferred with someone at high prices, went to his office every day. I remember probably the last time I saw Arthur, walking back from lunch at his club and to his office, considerable walk on a lovely, crisp, I remember the day, sunny day, and being stopped either three or four times by people whom he did not know to shake his hand, express admiration to Ambassador Goldberg, Justice Goldberg, the individual happened to say, I think on the third occasion, which maybe it was just three people, so close to his office, he said, "This is so annoying, this happens to me all the time." At which point I had great difficulty containing myself, because the greatest ambition Arthur had, even as a young man when I knew him, was to be recognized by strangers. And he never missed telling me about it, each and every occasion when this occurred. This happens to me on rare occasions, and it is very, very flattering. And I am annoyed, but I am so pleased.
When did he die? I remember you went to this funeral.
It must have been 5 or 6 years ago. I can't remember the exact date. Very impressive funeral. With a minimum of labor participation, I was just astounded. Lynn Williams was one of the few labor leaders who was there, except for his personal friends who had some vague labor connections, like me.
You mentioned that Edna, your second wife, went to law school. She was at Duke Law School, and that Richard Nixon was one of her classmates.
Well,
are there any stories or anything that you can remember that she, that you feel would be of significance, that would be interesting on?
Well, the main thing was charming Dick Nixon was, whenever we ran into him at reunions and such. I don't think I ever saw him as president, did as vice president, senator. And maybe once as president, I'm not sure, but always Dick Nixon, who in his professional life has been known for anything except charm, was a very nice guy to deal with. I can't say the same for his spouse. I remember the time Edna and I were at a nightclub in what was then the Americana Hotel in Bell Harbor, Florida. It's one of these things where you come to the early show or the late show, and then they kick you out, but you carry over. And we were on our way out, and people were standing in line, including the Nixons. So we stopped and chatted. By that time, Dick was a candidate for president, and Pat took one look after Dick introduced us, and I think determined that we were not a good source of political support potentially, and dragged him away from us rudely and promptly. Dick Nixon was a good president, that's what I remember most. He was not very prominent in school. And I remember Edna coming back from a reunion that Dick did not attend with, and they did something interesting. They took photostats of the applications to law school for all the students, distributed them at this alumni affair, And on Dick's application, where they say, what do you want to be or something, he wanted to be a politician. And of course, was.
Interesting. Ben, you mentioned in your tape, your 1977 tape, that you had as a guest speaker at Temple, I think it was Temple Sinai, Baird Rustman.
Not I had. He was brought in by, I suppose it was a huge UJF group that brought Baird in.
What? I personally felt that he was one of the intellectuals of the civil rights group or movement, and I wondered if you had any comments or...
Baird was an interesting fellow, very much attached to the labor movement, supported by the labor movement, financed by the labor movement, subservient to the labor movement. Very interesting, very effective fellow at the time when the civil rights movement was turning various channels, one of which was at least the black portion of it,